accession number 4844, reel 7.
Service cameraman, David Prusser, reel 7. What were the conditions for a newsreel cameraman attached to the Royal Air Force in 1943?
Fundamentally, one went to a bomber station, and by this time, in my case, and I think possibly in that of others who may have joined the station, we had already become war correspondents, therefore we were wearing one kind of uniform or another. In this particular case, I was probably wearing army uniform and would carry a badge saying British war correspondent on my shoulders on battle dress and so on. And the conditions were rather dubious to me because I hardly got off the ground. In fact, I did one or two tests with the camera in Hudson aircraft. But one was drawing kit, having medical tests and all this sort of thing, and one never really got going before suddenly my call-up papers arrived at home and my wife phoned the airfield and warned me that I'd better get in touch soonest. So I didn't really find very much. One lived as an officer, of course. One messed in the officer's mess, and one was just learning really what it was all about. Having spent most of the war hitherto with all three services in one way or another, but without actually operating in the same way. In this case, the basic plan of the thing was to do stories on air operations bombing the enemy, because there was no room for you in fighter aeroplanes. You could be squeezed in at a pinch in the rather primitive bombers we had in those days. Certainly the Hudson was so primitive that it was dubious whether it would ever even reach Germany. It might have reached somewhere in France and the Low Countries. But basically, I was very vague about what was going to carry on at all, except filming air operations from the air.
Night operations, presumably.
I wouldn't have thought so. No, I would have thought that there wasn't much point in filming night operations at that stage in the war, because we didn't have the effort to go far enough to do any of the major bombing raids that were later filmed for Bomber Command, where you did get enough actual bombs to show up. I mean, these aircraft were only capable of carrying for a very small bomb load. At 12,000 or 15,000 feet, they barely show up on film. And there weren't very many of them either. And I think, really, the whole thing only arose because at this time, the Americans had just started flying fortresses, and we had had a correspondent go on one or two of their operations, which were day operations, and we were hopeful, only hopeful, that we might get something of the same sort. That on a very much smaller scale, of course.
You were then called up.
Yes, this was all very sudden. In fact, it was so sudden that after I'd actually gone through the motions and gone through an aircrew selection board and been passed out as a pilot, I think I went on leave within a couple of days, because the whole thing had happened so quickly that I hadn't really been able to make any arrangements at all. Having had everything organised for Swanton Morley, I wasn't organised for a total change like this, and the Air Ministry was singularly cooperative and helpful, I suppose sympathetic almost about it. I should point out perhaps that I found out later that my call-up was due to my earlier volunteering before the war had started for this kind of work in the Air Force, and was known as an Air Ministry posting. In other words, it was organised by Air Ministry with a specific post in mind for me, as a director cameraman or a newsreel director cameraman or whatever. In fact, my actual title, once I was enrolled into the Royal Air Force, was, I think, aircraftman second class director cameraman. I had to work up from that by taking an aircrew course, in this case the shortest one, which was air gunnery, because although I was a past the pilot, Air Ministry again said, no, he can't waste 2 years training as a pilot, we'll have to get him the shortest one so we can get him airborne and get him working. This meant 6 weeks at Pembrey after the initial training. The initial training was a bit of a mistake, because I was being trained for ground crew, and every day they came round asking for volunteers for air crew, and I always stepped forward and they said, no, we know about you, you shouldn't be here at all. However, this went on for a few weeks, and I eventually got down to Pinewood Studios, and then on to Swanton Morley, still as a second-class aircraftman, where I did actually join at Swanton Morley, an operational film production unit with Flight Sergeant Lee Howard and Flying Officer Skeet Kelly, of feature fame. And I was very interested, after all the initial training, where one learned how to salute and all this sort of thing properly, and who to salute and when, which I'd already known with the Navy, and I was fairly tricky and careful about this in any case. But when I arrived at Pinewood, I was flinging up salutes to any officer that looked senior to me, and or anybody other than NCO, and I was told, you really shouldn't go around doing that, oh boy, we don't even wear caps here, a bit embarrassing, you know. And much the same sort of thing happened when I joined up with Flight Sergeant Howard and Skeets Kelly. In fact, we all used to muck in together and scrub the floors together. Skeets was technically in command, but we all did exactly the same sort of job. And after passing out my gunnery course at Pembrey, I moved to Hartford Bridge, again with Skeets Kelly. Hartford Bridge is now called Black Bush, where I was organizing cameras and aircraft and standing by to operate myself. And 4 days later, however, Skeets Kelly was shot down. But the next day we got news from Paris saying he's perfectly all right and he's working in a photographic shop and is safe. Following that, I actually did the air gunnery course and passed out and was recommended for a commission. That embarrassed my unit, my headquarters unit, somewhat, because they didn't have any establishment for a commissioned officer at that particular point. So I was eventually posted to 139 Wing, 2nd Tactical Air Force at Lasham, flying in B-25s or Mitchells. And by October, I was organized with IMO cameras and border fittings for shooting through the nose of the aircraft and through the bottom of the aircraft. And I achieved also at this point the main ambition that I'd set myself when I first joined the Air Force. That was to get a car allowance from the Royal Air Force to pay my expenses on running my own car between the station and Pinewood and home and back. So I then started operating with the Dutch Navy in 320 Squadron, mostly on no-ball targets. And this particular airfield at Lasham was so badly located that the whole wing was very often grounded for many days in fog. So sometimes we used to return to Pinewood and or home and leave a duty watch. And the trick was that we phoned up the duty watch every day. And if he said the birds are still walking, we knew the fog was still down. And there wasn't any further problem, we just stayed at home. And then you would get the word that the fog was lifting, or you'd hear the forecast or something, and you'd all tear back and start operating again.
Can you describe the size and composition of your film unit at Lasham?
Not very accurately, because I don't have any record of the numbers at that time. It was commanded initially by Jerry Pullen, who very shortly after went sick. And I took over command, I think as a sergeant initially, before my commission came through. There were several other sergeants and flight sergeants there. The only names that I can remember are Douglas Jones, who I think was a flight sergeant, and Bernie Easton, who was a sergeant. We had a bit of trouble with him because he was terribly orthodox, and the result was he had to, between Friday night and Saturday's sundown, he had to walk everywhere and couldn't go in a truck except to go and attack the enemy in an aeroplane. So it meant that he arrived at the section, which was about 3 miles away from the mess, about lunchtime, and then it was time to start walking back for the afternoon tea. So we didn't see very much of him every weekend.
He was an Orthodox Jew.
He was extremely Orthodox. I learned a great deal about Orthodoxy actually from him. He was the most educated chap. He was the son of a priest apparently, and could only marry a priest's daughter, and therefore was very rigidly restricted even to his diet. Anyway, apart from those two and Jerry Pullen, we had a number of either NCOs or officers attached to us at times for training, some with camera experience, some without, some of whom had been on air operations as pilots or navigators and had done two or three tours.
Was this always cine camera experience?
Yes, usually. There were one or two still men, or not professional still men, but men with stills experience.
But you were primarily a cine unit?
We were entirely a cine unit. But they were there for being to be trained by us. Jerry Pullen and I were the professionals. Bernie Easton wasn't, and Doug Jones wasn't. And to that extent, they were under training, but they were rather more advanced, of course, than some of the officers we got straight off operations.
When you say training, this wasn't a formal training course like was run at Pinewood, or was it?
No, it was not formal in any sense. In fact, it was entirely up to Jerry and myself how we worked it. We used to give them a good deal of instruction on the basics, but both Jones and Easton knew a good deal about photography anyway, so they knew the basis of the thing, and it was largely a question of getting them familiar with the cameras and telling them the kind of stuff we wanted. And I should perhaps make a point here that although technically one was a serving officer in the Royal Air Force, or at this time I was only a sergeant actually, but later on when I was commissioned, one still had practically the same degree of freedom in individual action on one's own responsibility as I had as a war correspondent. All right, you had to do one or two things that the station commander wanted done and things like that. But outside of that, you could go to almost any officer from Basil Embry, who was the Air Vice Marshal commanding 2 Group, downwards, and ask him for anything, and frequently be told you couldn't have it, but he didn't mind you asking. And I found this was the interesting part, that here was a unit which was respected by the Royal Air Force, although it was a totally untraditional one, even in the short tradition of the Royal Air Force. Therefore, one reacted and performed in very much the same sort of way as I had been doing in the Middle East as a war correspondent. One didn't get quite the same sort of facilities, but once one learned the way around the RAF methods of doing things, you found you could get most of the necessary things except for equipment. Cameras were in very short supply, lenses were in very short supply. In fact, a great many of our lenses for the IMOs were only fixed focus, which meant we couldn't shoot ground stuff with them because they wouldn't shoot anything closer than a long shot of the trees across the airfield. So we had certain restrictions in that respect. But this was not the fault of the unit. It was just the fact that we were launched into operating before we were really fully equipped, as ideal as one would have expected. But then this would apply in the newsreel business as well.
Were you just as much your own master in the RAF as you had been in Cairo? I'm thinking, did you decide which units you were, which operations you were going to film?
Yes, very largely. Group would indicate the sort of operations they would like intelligence material on, in which case it wasn't actually a command, but we were rather expected to film it. In any case, we would. 9 times out of 10, we filmed every operation, unless Group said, don't bother, old boy, it's not worth it. And one did this by, one performed this by liaison with the intelligence office on the airfield, and the intelligence officers, whoever was on duty, usually between about 11 o'clock at night and 2 in the morning, and you'd probably be operating at 6 or 6.30. So it meant liaison every night to pick up the information about the next operation. And in that sense, you could say, all right, well, I'm going to send 2 men on this if I can get them into the aircraft, if you thought it was worthwhile. And nobody in group would complain or punish you in any way if you took that sort of decision. And unless they said, we specifically want this one covered in black and white or colour or whatever, and you then refused to go, which was disobeying an order, unless you did that, which was, to my knowledge, never arose, there was no problem. But you could, in fact, cover it any way you liked, and nobody actually instructed or tried to tell you how to cover it. You might occasionally get instructions from Pat Moyner, the CEO of the unit at Pinewood, if he'd seen some rushes which he didn't think were adequate, and he'd say, next time, can you do better on this particular type of shot or this particular type of sequence? Or we want some ground stuff as well that you haven't got here. Outside of that, there were no directions.
Could you describe a typical operation?
Yes. They were mostly over the inshore areas of northern France, Holland and Belgium. They were daylight operations, and you normally flew at a height somewhere between 10 and 15 or 16,000 feet. And you would take off knowing pretty well what the target was. From the briefing, you'd know fairly well what the opposition was likely to be. We very seldom, for some odd reason, saw fighters. But we did experience enormously heavy flak. And if one can put in a comment about that in parentheses, it was rather a strange thing. You see, a lot of these operations would be launched, you would take off on them, and then you'd find the Met forecast was wrong and you couldn't see the target because of cloud. Now, in these days, it seems very strange you couldn't attack through cloud or have to worry about actually seeing a target. All contact, sea, air, or whatever, was visual. Radar was in its infancy. And later on, we did get very primitive radar sets for this sort of thing. But you had to be able to see it. And the consequence was that if you were turned back, the operation wasn't cancelled. It would probably go ahead the next day with a different flight plan. You'd have a different altitude and probably a different route. The interesting part about this was that the Germans had a very good source of information somewhere, particularly in relation to Lasham Airfield, and we never quite got to the root of this. And it wasn't, I don't think it was just pub talk in Alton by the crews that night, because they were jealous of their own safety as much as anybody else was. But the fact remains, the following day we would go on the operation on a given target, shall we say, in France. You'd probably have to fly over Dieppe, where there was a hell of a flat point. But it wasn't just a point, it was a very heavy concentration around Dieppe. I've forgotten what they had there that they were defending so heavily, but they used to bomb it from time to time. Anyway, you knew that if you were going that way, you'd get tremendous flak attack. Now, the funny thing was that if the previous day's operation had been laid on to fly over Dieppe, for the sake of argument, at a height of 15,000 feet, the following day we would probably go over on a different heading at 12,000 feet, and the flak would all still be at 15,000 feet. This we found very relieving, actually, because the Germans had an extraordinary fixation that they obviously had some way of finding out what the operation had been the previous day and what the briefing limitations had been, but they could not change their view. When they could find the aircraft at 12,000 feet, they still arranged their shells to burst at 15,000 feet. As far as the actual attack went, we used to have a standing system for filming them where you opened a hatch in the bottom of the aircraft, which was after the armoured door, which protected the crew, which meant the entire crew was in front of you. And having opened this hatch, you would then lie on the deck and poke your camera, probably handheld most of the time, out of the door, so that you could look downwards and slightly ahead, perhaps 40 degrees ahead, so you would see the bombs soon after they left the bomb bay. You would follow the bombs down, and you then very carefully sort of sighted them, centered on them, so that you could actually see them all the way and see their burst. This was the important thing from an intelligence point of view, obviously. And having done that, you would normally turn sharply away and climb steeply from the target. But as far as possible, it was almost imperative, in my view, that one kept the target in sight of the camera the whole way through that operation, so that you would not only see the bursts, you would subsequently see the kind of smoke that was coming up, and you would get a certain amount of detail as to whether you'd hit the target or not before the smoke got too thick. That really was the kind of operation. Then you would press on back.
Did you alter your lens during the shot?
Sometimes, not during the actual bombing normally. Occasionally one might film the target before one got to it on a long lens, and you might film it after you left it, but normally you had a standard lens depending on their altitude and the stability of the aircraft at the time, because if it was very bumpy, there was no point in trying to use a long lens. The stuff would be unusable, so you had to use a wider angle lens than otherwise. But I did from time to time experiment with switching to a 6-inch lens as one pulled away from the target, so if you would get close stuff, although you were climbing, you could still get some fairly close shots of the target and the bomb results. Not many of us did use 6-inch lenses. I tried to, because it was a habit I'd been used to with filming battles at sea and so on.
Was your camera ever affected by moisture at that height?
Not so much by moisture, because it was usually fairly dry and very cold. Our main trouble was static, which was an unheard of thing in those days, and to describe static on film, if you look at some of that material from in today's library stuff, you will see a lot of white crosses appear on the print. In other words, they're black on the negative. This is caused by a static discharge of electricity. For reasons for years, we never even found out how or why it happened. and it caused a miniature lightning flash across the film. In fact, it was due quite simply to the fact that the air was very dry, the film was usually very cold, and as the film unwound, rather like rubbing a piece of ebonite with flannel or something like that, it produced a spark as it unwound. So you've got almost a continual section of sparks developing before the film actually went through the film camera gate. And these would, of course, look like fog. They were absolutely black exposure on the negative, and hence the white marks on the film. And we had a lot of trouble getting rid of this. We tried earthing the cameras and went to all manner of technical efforts before it was discovered that all that was needed was a little moisture and a little warmth to prevent it.
So then you closed the camera, or what did you do then?
This wasn't discovered until after the war. In fact, we did, some of us used to take our Irving jackets off and wrap them round the camera, especially electrically heated ones, because we thought it was something like that, and this did cure the static. Or we kept the cameras very warm, right up to the moment of approaching the target. And this again solved the problem. But the main conditions were sort of cold, dry air.
This was a handheld camera?
Generally speaking, yes. The IMO, or most of the IMOs that we used, had a turret, which meant you could have three different focal length lenses on it, and you could swing from one to the other in perhaps 1.5 seconds by the time you'd unscrewed the mount of the turret, pulled it out, swung it around, put it back and got it locked in, and make sure the lens was focused and set correctly. This was not always easy to do, because you were flying at something in the region of perhaps 200 knots airspeed, and if you used too long a lens and you stuck it out of the aircraft too much, you've got a 200-knot air slipstream against it. So therefore the lens would vibrate, and sometimes it would defocus. It would rotate the lens barrel so that the focus was thrown out. Sometimes it would even alter the iris ring as well. So it always had to be stuck down with sticky tape and virtually preset on infinity so that it wouldn't be unwound by the slipstream or anything like that. Slipstream also caused vibration, of course, and so naturally did bumpy air if you went in too low on an operation, which wasn't very often, but if you had a very high wind or anything like that, you had problems that you couldn't use a long lens because the aircraft was bumping about so much and you couldn't hold the target in frame.
You also used fixed cameras. For instance, you have mentioned the border row camera.
Yes, this wasn't used very much. We started using it in the nose of Bostons in the beginning to film the targets, and we realized afterwards that you had to have another camera on board, in other words, if you used the border. You could do the run-up, but it meant the only way you could see what had happened to the target after it was bombed was to turn the aircraft around and fly over the target again, which is sometimes a bit hazardous. And naturally, crews weren't very keen to do this just for the sake of getting some pictures. The border row was a pretty ancient camera made by what became ultimately the Camiflex manufacturers in France, and it was really not up to the job. It was a belt driven thing with an electric motor, and it was a bit primitive and had to be mounted solid, and the only way it could be used was in cooperation with a similar camera mounted aft shooting through a streamlined mirror, so if you only mounted the mirror outside the aircraft just below the edge of the door, and the camera would look down vertically into this mirror, and then as you passed over the target, so you would see the target, the mirror would be lined up so you wasn't looking absolutely horizontally, it would be looking perhaps down at 45 degrees. So as you passed over the target, that would then come into frame. One of the interesting things about that was that Skeets Kelly and I, in the very early days when he was a flying officer, I think, and I was an AC-2, we were discussing which way round the mirror should be fitted for this particular film, or which way round the camera should be fitted in relation to the mirror, whether the camera should have its top facing the front of the aircraft or the other way round. And I regarded Skeets, being a features man, as being a professional in this kind of semi-trick photography, and thought, well, I suppose he knows what he's talking about. And I bowed to his jurisdiction on the way this was fitted, but I firmly believed and told Skeets that it should have been fitted the other way round. However, the result was, when this stuff was shown on the newsreels, it was almost a joke, because target stuff was beautiful. But the snag was that you saw the bomb bursts first, and then all the smoke contracted, and the bombs came back into the aircraft, because you got the camera the wrong way around.
When did you use colour film?
Only very occasionally, usually at the direction of intelligence. because they wanted to identify a particular effect on a target and to make sure they'd hit the right thing and that they were getting the right chemicals burning or whatever.
This was 35mm, was it?
No, this was only 16mm on a Kodak Special, which is a pretty terrible thing to use in the air. It's a very primitive 16mm camera, although very professional in its way, in its day. We were using 35mm cameras for everything else. But colour film wasn't in very great production at that time, and also it had to be brought over from the States, which meant further shortages. I think it was Kodachrome, which hadn't long been invented. It had only been produced when I was a student in about 1935 or 36. And so we couldn't get very much of it, so it wasn't in regular use. Furthermore, it was very expensive, particularly in terms of men and ships, in getting it over to UK from America. I think we did have some sort of facilities for processing it, but basically it was only there for intelligence purposes and not for transmission of newsreels or anything like that.
You were never able to take any 60mm colour film of life on the station?
No. This would have been regarded as extremely extravagant. There was no point, and I wouldn't even shoot, none of us would shoot anything like that on the ground that wasn't actually wanted by intelligence.
Did you always fly in Mitchells when you were a cameraman?
Yes, nearly always. I think I did one operation in Boston's. But certainly with 139 wing, I always flew exclusively in Mitchells.
What was the attitude of the crews of the planes in which you flew towards having a cameraman on board?
Usually very cooperative indeed, actually, because I only weighed about 140 pounds and I was rigged fairly well aft, so it didn't affect the bomb load in particular. I wasn't really getting in anybody's way because the whole of the crew were isolated from me by a steel armour plate. In fact, my post was simply to sit on top of a closed L-SAN lid between two windows with an open hatch in front of me, and the crew didn't even know I was there except when I answered back on the intercom. But they were immensely helpful and cooperative, and I became very good friends with one Dutch pilot in particular, who was a rather exceptional chap because he was fundamentally a navigator. He was given by the RAF a very unusual award in the sense that he was given the British Distinguished Flying Cross for navigation, for bomb aiming, that he's making history, and that was the actual citation. That was Kees Vaardenburg. And he, on one or two occasions, took me privately on flights with just himself and myself. No gunnery crew or anything else. This was so that we could move very fast, very much faster in the air than the rest of the aircraft, and we could move around them a bit. It was frowned on by group because had we been shot down in those circumstances, it would have been an unnecessary loss as far as group headquarters was concerned. But one used to get away with it occasionally because one wanted to get certain shots which were unobtainable any other way. And he was extremely cooperative, Vaardenburg.
Otherwise, how would you normally select which aircraft you wish to be in?
Usually from the pilot and crew, I think. I used to fly periodically with the wing commander flying, who was a South African. And he was always a press-on type. That is to say, he would go in almost regardless of anything and be pretty certain if anybody was going to hit the target, his crew would. This applied only to one or two other crews with whom I used to fly. Some of the crews would have engine trouble or some minor fault on the aircraft and turn back, or else they wouldn't be able to see the target and they'd turn back. And this clearly was a waste of time and effort to go with people like that who had a reputation. But it may not have been their fault, but if you knew that certain more junior officers were or did have a record of not always getting to the target when other people did, you tended to avoid flying with them. So this limited me down to three or four pilots, I suppose.
Your presence wouldn't encourage these pilots to press on?
Oh no, they were entirely professionals. This was not a matter for my comment at all. This was a matter for the official group record that Commander so-and-so has got the target 88 times out of 90, whereas several others from his unit have perhaps only made 50 attacks on the target in the same operations.
you describe a typical day when you were in this unit, filming operations?
Well, basically the day would start with getting the vehicle out. We had various kinds of vehicle along various times, but we eventually finished up, certainly when I was in command, with I think a 30 hundredweight Fordson truck. This was very important because we needed our own transport to get out to aircraft to fit cameras and this sort of thing. So a day would start, shall we say, for four of us, because at least four of us would be operational in one sense or another, airborne or groundborne at the time. And having had breakfast, whoever's duty day it was, before we left the mess, would check or do what I called a DI, a daily inspection, on the truck. This was to make sure that it was topped up adequately with oil, petrol, water, and that the tyres were at the right pressures and everything else, and it was fully operational for immediate use without any further delay. Then we would make the crew would make their way round to the operational section, which might be 2 or 3 miles away around the far side of the airfield, and certainly was at Lasham. And there we would do the same sort of checks with all the camera gear. Probably by this time, I or one of us would know what the intelligence situation was